The information shared in this podcast is intended for entertainment purposes only. It should not be considered as professional legal advice or a substitute for seeking professional legal advice. Divorce, custody battles, domestic violence. These cases unfold every day in family courts. But the stories don't end in the courtroom. The courtroom is just the beginning. This is Love, Lust, Law, and I'm your host, Michelle Locke. I spent 23 years practicing as a divorce attorney and presided over more than 5,000 cases as an associate court judge in Texas over a dedicated family violence court. I'm also the child of divorce, and after a 22-year marriage, I've been through one of my own. When I say I've lived every side of family law, I mean it. Now I'm bringing that expertise to the mic so we can unpack the legal battles fueled by love, lust, power, money, betrayal, and survival. Today, I'm joined by Jake Deptula, a seasoned victim advocate and podcaster, who also happens to be my friend and executive producer. He'll be joining me as we take a closer look at one of the most volatile and high-profile divorces of the early 2000s, Charlie Sheen and Denise Richards. From the outside, their life looked ideal. Charlie was a star of Two and a Half Men, and Denise had made a name for herself through modeling and acting. But behind the scenes, things were unraveling fast. By the time Denise filed for divorce, she was 7 months pregnant with their second daughter and keeping detailed notes of what she said was escalating verbal abuse, drug use, gambling, and threats that left her fearing for her life. Today, we're going to walk through what happened, not as gossip, but as a case study, because the legal issues at play here aren't unique to celebrities. Supervised visitation, restraining orders, verbal and physical abuse. These are conversations happening every day in family courtrooms across the country. We've got a lot to get into, so let's get started. Charlie Sheen has been a household name for nearly four decades. He broke out in 1986 with the Vietnam War drama Platoon and followed it up a year later with a starring role in Wall Street alongside his father, Martin Sheen, Michael Douglas, and Daryl Hannah. From there, Charlie's star continued to rise. He took on roles in Young Guns, Major League, and Men at Work, cementing his place as a leading man in the late 80s and early 90s cinema. But during that same time, Charlie was also making headlines for reasons that had nothing to do with acting. In January 1990, Charlie's fiancée, actress Kelly Preston, was injured after a gun went off in their home. The exact details of what happened have never been confirmed. All we know is that Kelly required stitches in her arm, and reports at the time suggested that Charlie may have fired the gun, whether intentionally or by accident. Both Charlie and Kelly denied that version of events. Years later, Kelly told TMZ it was an accident.
Charlie also shared his side of the story. According to Charlie, it was a freak accident. He wasn't even in the room when the gun went off. He said, "I was downstairs and I heard a gunshot go off. I thought, she did it. She killed herself. They're going to blame me." He said when he found Kelly, she was standing in blood. She told him that when he lifted his pants off the scale in the bathroom, the revolver he carried fell out and shot a bullet right between her legs and hit the toilet bowl. A piece of shrapnel from the toilet then hit Kelly. That's what caused her injury. Whatever the truth, the couple split not long after. Charlie entered rehab for substance use while Kelly started dating John Travolta. It didn't get a lot of coverage. There wasn't TMZ.
I don't remember this. I don't remember it at all.
I think that's what people tend to forget. Like, he was an A-list leading man, major star, prime for decades of success. This didn't get the coverage that you'd think it would. Nowadays, it would be all over the place. But back then, there was a very limited amount of things. There were tabloids, Entertainment Tonight. Charlie was a major star at this time. Charlie had come off of two Academy Award winning movies, Platoon, which won Best Picture, Wall Street, Young Guns, Major League. I mean, he was a major star.
I was younger, like you, when some of these movies came out. I remember Young Guns. I mean, Emilio Estevez was in it. I remember Young Guns. Was it Neil Diamond Phillips was in it?
Neil Diamond Phillips. Neil Diamond Phillips, a great singer.
Lou Diamond Phillips, is that correct?
Yes, Lou Diamond Phillips. I love the mashup, though, Neil Diamond and Lou Diamond Phillips. That would be a great mashup.
That would be a good mashup.
Maybe South Park should get on that.
South Park should get on that. But I remember Young Guns. I loved Major League. I thought Tom Berenger was like the hottest thing in that movie. I was much younger, of course. Clearly, I've always had a thing for older men. That's a different discussion for a different day. But yeah, I remember it. But I never heard about the toilet bowl or the gun incident.
It was kept very quiet. And I imagine at the time, again, due to the limited amount of news outlets. We're talking, you know, decades before social media. So it was a time where reps wanted to bury a story. It could be done.
This was like the times where the National Enquirer was what broke gossip.
Yes. I mean, TMZ, for all the good and the bad, has now become a source of credibility for celebrity news. Again, going back to your old adage, where there's smoke, there's fire, they have tipsters. I mean, how often do you see when a TMZ camera happens to be at the airport and finding somebody get off a plane?
Well, that never happens because I'm in Texas and LA must be a totally different experience when you go to the airport, but I've never seen a TMZ camera at the Austin airport.
They have tipsters all over the place. I know people who worked in food service and bars and things like that, clubs in the LA area over the years, and TMZ would approach them, or at least their operative, somebody representing themselves as TMZ, would say, hey, here, if you know somebody comes in here, we'll give you $500 for the tip. We'll give you $1,000 for the tip.
I'm so missing out. Like, I would love to be in on the gossip. That's why I love family law.
I don't think your profession allows you to do that. I think the state bar in Texas may have a problem with it.
No, I can't tell, but I can sure receive. I mean, I like to be in the know. I go to TMZ every single morning. It's part of my morning news routine.
It's kind of like your morning meditation. I've noticed that about you. You really do like to gossip, or at least live vicariously through the gossip on TMZ. I've noticed that about you.
It's not even living vicariously. What I really do is I like knowing the story behind the headlines, because the headlines, while they're interesting, there's so much more. And that's kind of why we do Love Lost Law, is to get behind the headlines, because it's so much more interesting once you understand the nitty-gritty details or why we got to the headlines, right? There's just so much more to the story that the news just doesn't have the time to do. So that's what I love doing this show in particular. Speaking of headlines, in July of 1995, Charlie was back in them, this time for his involvement with Hollywood Madam Heidi Fleiss. According to his own court testimony, Charlie had hired sex workers from Heidi at least 27 times, paying more than $50,000. Charlie was testifying under a limited grant of immunity, and we'll get to that in a minute. And around the time he testified, Charlie had met model Donna Peel 6 weeks later in September 1995. They got married, but the marriage didn't last. 5 months after the wedding, they got divorced. Now, limited granted immunity. This happens, and I've seen cases before, where immunity is granted to, I guess, the Johns, so to speak, because they have the bigger fish to fry. And I think that's what they gave him. It's limited immunity for him committing criminal acts, because hiring prostitutes is a criminal act, I mean, as defined in the California Penal Code, probably at the time. But they wanted to get Heidi. They weren't targeting him. And so they gave him some kind of limited immunity for specific acts over a specific period of time so that he could come testify in front of a grand jury or testify in court so that they could actually have his testimony without him pleading the fifth.
Charlie is the original Hollywood bad boy from the era. But I also find this very fascinating, is that the fact that he unashamedly would admit to hiring sex workers, and one of his famous lines about that is that, I didn't pay them to show up, I paid them to leave. I'm paraphrasing.
I'm sure you are. I mean, there's not many times I'm speechless.
He wasn't hiding shit.
His attitude was, fuck it.
Yeah.
Excuse my language. But it was.
The gun thing, to me, is the one suspicious thing, because, I mean,
a gun goes off by itself? Come on now.
I do believe that he had a gun tucked into his sweatpants. That's a total Charlie Sheen.
That I believe.
Yeah. It's unclear exactly why Donna Peel and Charlie split. Charlie later told Us Weekly that he ended the marriage after becoming a born-again Christian. He also claimed a voice warned him the relationship wouldn't work. He said, there was a voice, not the drug-induced voices, but there was a voice that kept telling me this will not work. I think it's very telling that he said not the drug-induced voices. So even back then, Charlie was showing signs of how drugs were impacting his life. And he was clear about that.
Well, yeah. It was like, I hear voices, but they weren't the drug ones. They were the other voices. Because that's
because
normal.
That's usual. Like, you take drugs and you hear voices.
That's usual. Yeah. I'm like, you know, doc, I got some drug-induced voices, but those ones, they're okay. It's the other voices.
Yeah, well, at least he can clarify. At least he can distinguish between what voices are coming from where.
Can he really, though? I mean, really?
I don't know. We'll have to ask him.
We'll have to ask him. Later that year, Charlie began dating actress Brittany Ashland. It wasn't long before things turned violent. According to court documents, on December 20th, 1996, Charlie grabbed her by the hair and slammed her onto the marble floor of his home, knocking her unconscious and splitting her lips so badly she needed 7 stitches. Brittany claimed Charlie then forced her to strip and dispose of her bloody clothes and threatened to kill her if she told anyone. 2 months later, Brittany filed a lawsuit accusing Charlie of assault, battery, negligence, false imprisonment, and emotional distress. She sought unspecified damages. Police investigated and prosecutors charged Charlie with misdemeanor battery causing serious injury. Charlie initially pled not guilty while a spokesperson called the lawsuit a cheesy attempt at extortion, adding, "It's the typical price you pay for being a celebrity in today's age." But in June 1997, Charlie entered a no-contest plea and received a 1-year suspended prison sentence and 2 years probation.
He was also ordered to pay $2,800 in fines and restitution, perform community service, and attend 8 counseling sessions. Rehab was part of the deal, too. At sentencing, Charlie told the judge, "I feel this is very fair and I'm grateful. You will not see me back in this courtroom." But that promise didn't hold. In 1998, he violated his probation after overdosing on cocaine and he was ordered back into rehab. Michelle, as a former judge, what are your thoughts on the sentence?
So I'd like to explain it a little bit from the plea start, because in the beginning, he pled not guilty. And everyone thinks, well, not everyone, I hate to use the generalizations, but lots of people in the public domain think that your initial court appearance, that you're going to plead guilty if you did it. You always enter a plea of not guilty. I don't know a single case where your first appearance in court, you don't plead not guilty. That's just how the system works. And so I see oftentimes media outlets will, he pled, so-and-so pled not guilty at their first appearance. Well, duh, he's going to plead not guilty or she's going to plead not guilty because that's how the system works. You have to enter a plea of not guilty to get through your discovery process, to get it set for trial, to do all those things. So whenever the media says, their initial appearance, they pled not guilty, that's what's supposed to happen. That's not newsworthy. That was expected. That was planned. That is how it works before we get to the next steps. That being said, when we get to 1997, where he actually entered a no contest plea. And to explain the semantics of no contest, you are not saying, "I'm guilty, I did it." What you are saying is, "I'm not going to contest it, but the court still finds you guilty." And that's an important distinction, because when you plead guilty, "I'm guilty, I did it," and the court enters that finding of guilt. In a no contest, it's like, "I'm just not going to fight the charges," and the court still enters a guilty finding. So he was found guilty. That's what happened when he did the no contest plea. Now, I don't know the details if he was put on some kind of deferred, which means the guilty finding doesn't actually get entered until he either unsuccessfully completes it or if he successfully completes his terms of probation, the case gets dismissed. I don't know the specifics of what happened behind the scenes, but I can tell you typically he was put on probation. And when you're on probation, you have a set of guidelines that you are to follow. And if you don't follow, you get your probation, what we call revoked, which means you are subject to the full range of punishment on that particular offense as a general rule, at least on deferred. If you have an underlying sentence and you're put on probation under regular like guilt finding, like for example, you were given a 5-year sentence, but you were placed on probation. So generally speaking, the max the judge can sentence you is whatever you have left on that 5 years. If you've done 3 years of probation, they can sentence you to 2 more years in jail. I think most jurisdictions, again, some states do it differently. So to go back to what it thinks about his deal, restitution was probably medical bills or counseling. A restitution is to make the victim whole as a general rule. And so I don't know what the amounts of restitution were, but it's probably most likely for her therapy, her medical expenses, something along those lines. The fines are going to be statutorily defined. And it was in California, so whatever California defined that those fines should be. Community service, 8 counseling sessions, I'd be willing to bet with some kind of anger management or family violence counseling, and rehab, which tells me that he was under the influence of substances when the offense happened, is what that would indicate to me. Typically, you're going to find in domestic violence cases in particular, and I know Jake, you can probably talk about this, how often alcohol or cocaine are involved.
the interweaving between substance abuse and domestic violence are off the charts statistically.
I mean, it's off the charts. So it just doesn't surprise me that rehab was part of it, because it would just indicate to me that he was high on some illegal substance or drunk. But knowing his history, I would probably gather it was cocaine. But we don't know. I can just tell you that because rehab was part of the deal, tells me that substance abuse, or he was under the influence of substances at the time the offense occurred.
When the public sees the sentencing that are handed down in celebrity cases, normally the public thinks that the sentence is quite lenient because of the prestige or the status of the celebrity. But you know this being a judge, how charming celebrities can be in court, or how good, depending upon their performance ability, of actors they are. We've seen this in many videos, like things that you don't know if the actor is being sincere or they really do want to take accountability for their actions.
Oh, that's every defendant in a courtroom.
Is it?
I talk about when you practice criminal defense, you generally speaking have clients that are, I wouldn't say bad people, but committed crimes on their best behavior. Family law is the converse. It's really good people on their worst days when they're getting divorced. Judges, as a general rule, get really adept at listening to, oh, I'm sorry, oh, I'm sorry, oh, I'm sorry. And they hear it from all the defendants. All the defendants that go in are going to play nice, are going to say what they think the judge wants to hear, because the judge has their fate in their hands. Really, the test is probation. You're either going to make probation or you're not. And if you don't make probation, that tells the court that what you said was either true or not true. I don't care who you are that walks into a courtroom. I don't care. Soldiers will come in, armed forces will come in their uniform, thinking that that's going to make the judge go easier on them. I don't care what you're wearing. I don't care who you are. I don't care what you do. Lady Justice is blind. And that is what I firmly believe. And I know some people say, well, that's idealistic. That's not really how it works. I'm a believer in the system, and I think it really does work the way it's supposed to 90% of the time. There are exceptions, just like there's bad doctors and bad lawyers, there's bad judges, but that's not the norm. I think that is the exception, not the rule. The people that really go into being a judge, you're not doing it for the money. Let's be real clear about that. They're doing it because they have a higher desire to do something else. So I just don't think that Charlie Sheen, no matter how much he tried to snowball a judge, the judge is going to go, yeah, whatever. Okay, we'll see how you do on probation. Because that's really what it is. It's, well, these things sound great, and I hope you mean them, and we will see over the next 24 months. Despite the chaos in Charlie's personal life, his acting career kept moving forward. In 2000, he replaced Michael J. Fox in the final two seasons of Spin City. And that's where another key person in the story comes in. In 2001, 36-year-old Charlie, who is newly sober, was on a set when actress and model Denise Richards landed a 5-episode guest role. Denise had spent more than a decade building her career. She had one-off roles on shows like Saved by the Bell, 90210, and Seinfeld. But her big break came in 1997 with Starship Troopers. I remember that movie. Then came Wild Things. Well, that was a scandal movie. And everything changed. Denise became a global sex symbol and was ranked number 9 on Maxim's 50 Sexiest Women's list. From there, her acting career continued to rise. She even landed a role as a Bond girl. And in 2001, she crossed paths with Charlie on the Spin City set. Not long after Denise joined Spin City, Charlie invited her over to watch a baseball game. Denise later told People, "Everyone told me not to go out with him, but I didn't want to judge him based on the tabloids or his past." She believed in second chances. Charlie told Denise he was sober, and while he'd previously hired sex workers, he had never been with them while sober. Those choices were behind him. He also said he was still active in Alcoholics Anonymous and had a sponsor. Denise believed him, and she agreed to the date. And as soon as she got to his place, there was an instant connection. She later said, "He was Mr. Polite, such a gentleman." So she made the first move and kissed him. Their relationship moved quickly, and within months, they were engaged. Charlie told reporters, "She taught me more about myself than anybody I've ever been close to. I just feel so supported all the time." In June 2002, they got married. Denise later said there was no prenup. We've talked about prenups a couple of episodes. Some people, and I'm going to quote my stepdad, on prenup said, they're the most unromantic thing in the entire world. And I can understand why he says that. And so because of that, I can see actors who are caught up in the love and the emotions are no different than you and I, Jake. And it's like, no, we don't need that. We'll be together forever. I mean, that is so common to get married without a prenup. I think it's more the exception, not the rule, to actually have a prenup. And so they were probably madly in love. He was sober and no one thought things would go south.
In 2003, Charlie began starring in Two and a Half Men, a role he took on at Denise's suggestion. It turned out to be the perfect move. The show catapulted him to the top of the TV world, eventually making Charlie the highest paid actor on television, earning nearly $2 million per episode. Pretty much by the mid-90s, Charlie's prospects really dried up when it came to leading major motion pictures. So him actually doing Spin City, taking over for Michael J. Fox, was a very smart move. And an even shrewder move was doing Two and a Half Men. From the standpoint of financially and otherwise, it became a juggernaut for him. It basically reinvented him.
Oh, I loved Two and a Half Men. It was hilarious.
The show became a huge hit, and it was extremely valuable for Charlie financially, but also really to get him back into the public lexicon in terms of relaunching him into that and basically reestablishing his foothold as a household name. He had already been famous for almost 20 years at this point. So it was really a smart move that Denise guided him in order to get to this point and take the show.
Behind every successful man is what, Jake? Seriously?
A successful lawyer?
Jiminy Christmas.
That's actually true.
People, you see what I'm dealing with?
That's true, though. That's true. Every successful man has a successful lawyer. Two reasons. One, the lawyer is successful in achieving the man's goals. Secondly, correct, the lawyer should be successful because the man makes so much money that he can afford to pay a successful lawyer. Done.
That is correct. But I was going to say, behind every successful man is a woman that has helped make him successful, like Denise did for him.
Oh, I see. That's one way to look at it. But I would say another way to look at it is that I think you should please do a quote, behind every successful man, ... is a successful lawyer.
Listen, I don't disagree with you. Behind every successful man is absolutely a successful lawyer. So in spring 2004, Charlie and Denise welcomed their first daughter, Sam. That fall, they became pregnant again with their second daughter, Lola. But behind the scenes, things were unraveling. According to court documents later filed by Denise, problems started as early as the honeymoon when Charlie took Xanax and told her to keep it secret, saying AA would consider it a relapse. Then 6 months into the marriage, Denise said she discovered Charlie was gambling heavily. He had a bookie, was betting on sports every day, and his mood swung wildly depending on whether he won or lost.
Denise described his behavior as volatile, saying that the smallest thing would set him off, and he would scream obscenities. She began walking on eggshells. And when she asked him to get help, he refused.
As the marriage continued, Denise said Charlie was abusing prescription drugs he purchased online, including Xanax, Ativan, and Norco, which is an opioid. When she confronted him, Charlie insisted prescription drugs weren't a problem because his past rehab was for alcohol and cocaine. But they clearly were a problem because he lied repeatedly about his usage, and she later found pills hidden in a safe and in his bathrobe pocket. According to Denise, Charlie also became threatening. While she was pregnant with their first daughter, Sam, he told her she better not tell anybody about the drugs and should keep it to herself. She stayed silent because she was terrified of what he'd do to her. Charlie had an image to protect, and she feared he was willing to do anything to maintain it.
Denise stated in court documents that after Sam was born, Charlie was briefly on his best behavior, but that changed quickly. Within weeks, he became verbally abusive again, this time because she stopped breastfeeding. He accused her of causing brain damage by switching to formula, saying it would make their daughter developmentally delayed. Denise said he didn't do any research. He simply latched onto those beliefs without evidence. Things escalated again when Denise took Sam to get her routine infant vaccinations. Charlie told Denise she had poisoned their daughter and called her a bad mother. Then he threatened to kill her. So Denise locked him out of the house.
When Charlie returned, he threw a flower pot at the front door, denting it. Denise said that once he calmed down, she let him in but began packing to leave with Sam. While she was in her office, Charlie kept arguing about the vaccinations and then threw a swivel chair at her. Denise packed a bag, went to Sam's room, and carried her out to the car. Charlie saw what was happening on the security cameras. He ran outside, tried to block Denise from getting into the car. He physically pushed her and pulled her and said she couldn't take Sam. He told her he would have her arrested for kidnapping. Then he yanked her keys from her hand and threw them at her car, denting it. Denise managed to leave and stayed at her parents' house for several days.
But things didn't end there. While Denise was gone, Charlie reportedly called Sam's pediatrician and left threatening messages because they had given his daughter vaccines. The doctor called Denise to say they would no longer treat Sam. The entire situation, especially Charlie's behavior toward the doctor, left Denise terrified for Sam's safety. She threatened to leave and Charlie promised he would quit gambling and stop using. But nothing changed.
Can I tell you how often we see this cycle? The fight with the doctor's office happens in so many cases where there's a power struggle between the parents. And oftentimes it's the abuser that will call and then threaten the doctor's office. You don't have my permission to treat. You gave these in violation. And doctors nowadays, and this was back in 2003, but doctors nowadays readily say, nope, not treating you anymore. So what we have happen on some cases is there's no doctors to treat. And so all the kids can do is go to urgent care. But it can become a real problem. So back to Charlie and Denise. And in October 2004, 7 months after Denise and Charlie welcomed Sam, Denise learned she was pregnant again. Charlie assured Denise that he wanted to be a family and make it work. And for a moment, Denise wanted to believe him. But things only got worse. Charlie kept gambling, losing hundreds of thousands of dollars, and continued using drugs. He was still abusive. He became increasingly paranoid. The smallest thing could set him off. Denise was terrified for her safety, but she felt frozen. She didn't know what to do.
By February 2005, Denise was 5 months pregnant, and things were really bad with Charlie. One day, she found pills on the floor of their home, the home that they shared with an 11-month-old baby. For her, that was the final straw. She told Charlie she wanted a divorce.
Charlie moved out, but then on or around February 28th, he came back to visit Sam and announced he was moving back in. Denise told him to leave, but Charlie refused. He became verbally abusive, screaming and pointing his finger at her. That night, he slept in their old bedroom. Denise stayed in Sam's room with her, but even there, Charlie wouldn't leave Denise alone. He came into Sam's room and kept yelling. The next morning, after Charlie left for work, Denise packed her and Sam's bags, checked into a hotel, and filed for divorce. She cited irreconcilable differences and requested legal and physical custody of both children with visitation rights for Charlie. So, this moving back in tactic, can I tell you it's a real tactic that I find to be so bad, is so unhealthy, and I wish there were some attorneys that would not advise their clients to move back in. Because while they may have the right, it doesn't mean it's the smart thing to do for exactly this reason. And once you leave, stay away. I mean, if your marriage is crumbling, if things are going south, if you've left, or if you're the wife and you've left, don't go back. Because then you're going back into a heightened dynamic that, especially if you come from some kind of verbal or physical abuse, but you're going back into a heightened dynamic where everyone is amped up and that cannot be good for anyone's safety, let alone good for a healthy environment to raise a child in.
Things continued to escalate between Charlie and Denise. Everything came to a head in April. One day, Charlie was scheduled to have visitation with Sam at Denise's home per an attorney-arranged agreement. Denise wasn't present, but security guards were. During the visit, Charlie took a large wedding photo off the wall. He then sawed it in half and spray-painted across it, "The dumbest day of my life." When Denise returned home, her security guard warned her and suggested she seek a restraining order. She took his advice and eventually the two entered a mutual restraining order agreement. The stipulation was signed but never filed with the court.
So it looks like they had a private judge in their divorce case early on. And so she went through the private judge to get restraining orders issued. And apparently there was some backlash from that particular private judge about ruining Charlie's career. And I know probably why they used a private judge was to keep it out of the media. But sometimes, as we learned from some other cases we've already covered, you don't have a choice and you have to go deal with it in the public courtroom. And that's what she apparently had to do ultimately to go get a restraining order, to go to the courtroom and get one from in the public arena, which puts their entire case on display. In June, Denise gave birth to their second daughter, Lola. Now that they had two children, Denise decided to organize a small intervention. She stated in court documents that she was terrified, but felt it was something she had to do for both Charlie and for their daughters. She wanted to be able to tell her children that she tried everything to make the relationship work. At the intervention, Charlie admitted to using drugs and agreed to get help. He started attending AA, began detox, and brought in a sober companion to monitor him. He appeared remorseful and seemed committed to recovery.
By the fall of 2005, Charlie and Denise were attempting to reconcile. Charlie moved back in, but only part-time. He maintained a separate residence and continued spending evenings there. After a few months, Denise had a feeling he was doing that so he could continue seeing sex workers. It seemed Charlie wasn't as fully committing to making things work as she was. Still, she stayed.
In December 2005, Charlie and Denise took a trip to Barbados without their daughters. Denise said in court documents that the purpose of the trip was serious. She wanted to confront Charlie about his behavior away from everyone else and encourage him to seek help for the sake of their children. The night they arrived, Denise tried to raise her concerns about the sex workers and about some pornography she'd recently found on his computer. Charlie told her he had a madam and that sex workers were emailing him. He claimed he only used them while they were separated. Denise didn't believe him. She told Charlie she felt the relationship was over, but that she was still concerned about him as a father. Charlie responded that he didn't see anything wrong with what he had done and said, "Since you filed for divorce, those are the consequences and you deserve it." He told her he wouldn't give up gambling or pornography and that she needed to accept it. Denise said she couldn't.
They continued arguing through dinner, with Charlie trying to justify his behavior. Afterward, back in the suite, Denise packed her bag and moved into a separate bedroom. She called her travel agent and booked a commercial flight home for the next day. Charlie was furious, not because she was leaving, but because he didn't want her flying commercial. They had arrived via private plane, and he didn't want her being seen on a commercial flight. In the end, they both agreed to fly home the next day on the private plane. They didn't speak during the entire flight.
I gotta tell you, I've seen this fact scenario play out in some cases, and I can't tell you how often the person who has NPD or some kind of traits of NPD, which is narcissistic personality disorder, will say, "Well, you filed for divorce. Consequences are on you." Like, it's, they take no accountability for their part in getting to why the other person filed for divorce. It's like, "Nope, you filed. It's on you." Holy cow. Like, I'm almost getting some PTSD from what happened in their, like, that last trip to Barbados. I mean, it's like textbook.
One of the things that does not fly over my radar here is how privileged you can be in a situation like this where you have the option to either fly commercial or take a private plane. If you really look at the fabric of this, imagine being in a scenario where you have resources like this. And how many people do not have resources like this? How many people have to flee in the middle of the night escaping from a nightmare vacation with their significant other based on the abuse that they're receiving?
Or you have to suck it up until you can get home. I mean, that's the worst part is if you're in a foreign country and you're with an abuser, you're stuck.
Yeah.
You're stuck.
Not to take anything away from the dynamics of their situation, but I mean, when you look at it and you break it down, most people don't have resources like this. And to your point, if you are trapped in a foreign country, things can be very difficult for you when you're trying to escape a allegedly abusive significant other.
So, after returning from Barbados on their private plane, Charlie and Denise went back to their own homes. Denise didn't immediately restart the divorce proceedings. With Christmas approaching, she said she feared how Charlie might react. She wanted to keep the peace for the children's sake, even though she knew their marriage was over. They made plans to spend Christmas Eve together with the girls, but on Christmas Eve morning, Charlie called to say he'd be spending the day at his house gambling. So Denise canceled, obviously, the dinner plans.
On Christmas Day, they were supposed to spend the day at Denise's parents' house. Denise hoped they would attend together for the children. According to Denise, Charlie came by at 7 a.m. to see the girls, but he was angry and on edge. He stayed for only an hour and refused to go with Denise to her parents. So she went alone with the children. Michelle, how often do you see situations like this where one parent is trying super hard to make it work for the kids and the other person can't rise to that level?
Oh, I wish I could say like 90%, but the holidays are particularly tricky. And that's why you will see quite often the divorce filings spike mid-January, early February, because they just had to survive the holidays because you didn't want to ruin those memories for the kids. And it happens a lot. It happens a lot. It was a problem that each and every parent going through a divorce with children has to deal with during the holidays, is how do we protect the kids? And here is my perspective on it. And Jake, you've heard me say this before. The children, Sam and Lola, didn't ask for their parents to have this disagreement to get divorced. They didn't ask for their dad to have the issues that he purportedly had. They didn't ask for that. But what we owe our children as parents is a good childhood to the best of our ability. And so it is incumbent upon us, even when we're going through divorces, to try and not ruin the kids' holidays, because those are their childhood memories. And you want to ensure that those children have the childhood memories that are ones that are not going to end them up on a therapist's couch down the road. Divorce and holidays is tricky, and most people just try and get through the holidays. And then usually by January 15th, the holiday glow is over, and it's like, I'm out. And really, yeah, I start seeing people start coming in October, November, December, saying, I want to get out, just want to get through the holidays. And then I got the phone call like on January 12th or 15th, please file. Okay. Quite common.
He's seemingly very transparent, whether she believes him or not. He is not making any apologies for who he is.
He's saying, take it or leave it.
Yeah.
On December 27th, Charlie came by Denise's while the girls were out walking with their nanny. Denise asked to speak privately and brought him into her office. Denise told Charlie she had found disturbing pornography websites he had accessed. Charlie didn't deny it. He insisted there was nothing wrong with the sites, and he told her to turn her head. Denise told him that as a mother of two young daughters, she was alarmed and that she believed he shouldn't be around the children. She asked if he had taken an AIDS test. He said yes. When she asked to see the results, he told her to go fuck herself and stormed out of the house. Denise followed him outside and tried to talk to him again about his behavior and how it could affect his relationship with the girls. That's when he told her, this is your last warning. You won't lay your head down at night. Denise took this as a death threat. Charlie then struck her wrist, shoved her in the stomach with both hands, and got into his car.
Jesus Christ.
That is a death threat. Context is everything.
No, it
is. Context
is
everything.
Absolutely. You won't lay your head down at night?
Yeah.
5 minutes later, he called her. According to Denise, Charlie threatened her again. Do not go down this road. You will regret it. He repeated, this is your last warning. Don't fuck with me. Denise was terrified for herself and the children. She immediately contacted her attorney and reinstated the divorce proceedings. Her lawyer contacted Charlie's legal team the same day. Michelle, is this the type of case where you'd recommend the spouses only communicate via their attorneys? And then what would you say to a client who is in Denise's situation?
This is the type of case where I would recommend very much so that the parties do one of two things. Communicate exclusively through attorneys, but that gets expensive. The other alternate is using a co-parenting program. Our Family Wizard is probably one of the bigger ones that's used. There is a program called App Close that is free, doesn't have the subscription cost that Our Family Wizard does, but it's a third-party platform for the parents to exclusively communicate on. And the great part about those programs is they have basically third-party oversight. And what I mean by that is the guardian ad litem can log in and check the communications. In theory, the judge can log in and see the party's communications. The attorneys can log in and see the party's communications. And so it is not private text messages where you're threatening each other. You can even go so far as recording or having the kids talk with the other parent, and it's recorded on those platforms. This is the type of case where you have these dynamics, these threats, this continual roller coaster of problematic behavior that would necessitate some kind of third-party intervention. It could be a parenting coordinator, a parenting facilitator. It could be some kind of family therapist. I mean, it would definitely be something where I'm telling the parties, no more person-to-person communications. You all need to use another forum to communicate. It's too easy to text something terrible at 10 o'clock at night versus if you're on a program that you have to log into that you know a court can see, that's probably going to temper your behavior. I will tell you, there are cases, and I've seen them because this evidence has come into the courtroom, where even those programs don't stop them from doing so. Now, you had the last question was about what do I advise women or men in Denise's position? When it gets that heated, I usually tell them, go to VRBO, Airbnb, go somewhere where you don't normally go and stay for a few days with the kids to let things cool off. I typically advise them, if you can leave the marital residence, if you can leave where he knows you are typically at, then do so until we can get a restraining order in place, we can get a protective order in place, or we can get something so that we can de-escalate the situation. But typically the answer is not staying where you are at. So on December 30th, Charlie was scheduled to visit the children at Denise's house with a nanny present. Denise was not supposed to be home during the visit. But Charlie arrived early while Denise was still there and the nanny hadn't yet arrived. He parked behind her car in the driveway, blocking her in. Denise answered the door while holding Lola. Sam was nearby, playing on the floor. Charlie followed Denise into the living room. He said he was angry and that she had told her attorney about what happened on December 27th and began verbally assaulting her again. In front of the girls, Charlie said, "You're fucking with the wrong guy." And he told her he wouldn't agree to supervised visitation, which was under discussion at the time. Denise stayed calm. She told him to speak to his attorney and be honest about his actions. But Charlie doubled down, warning her again not to reveal anything. Then he began calling her names in front of the children. Fucking bitch, asshole. And one of my personal favorites, cunt. It's not my personal favorite. I hate that word. It should never be used, but it seems to be a go-to in situations like this.
Denise said she was still holding Lola when Charlie moved toward her. She raised her hand to block him, but Charlie shoved her, pushing her between her shoulders. Denise fell backward over a child's toy and landed on the floor with Lola in her arms. Sam was screaming and crying. So was Lola. When Denise was still on the floor, Charlie pointed to her and yelled, "I hope you fucking die, bitch." Denise pulled her daughters onto the couch and tried to calm them down. As Charlie walked out, he threatened her again. "You are fucking with the wrong guy. I'm going to have you killed."
After Charlie left, he called Denise repeatedly. Fearing for her and the children's safety, she told her security team to deny him entry under any circumstance. Denise also wanted to go to court immediately for a new restraining order. Her and Charlie's attorneys agreed to hold a hearing with a private judge in early January 2006. The judge granted the restraining orders, but Denise later learned they were once again never signed or filed with the court. At the hearing, Denise agreed to provide updates about the children through their attorneys, while Charlie agreed to a 30-day cooling-off period with no contact with Denise or the children. What would I do? Oof. The problem is you have someone in active addiction is what it appears like, right? Just based on the rages, based on his behavior. If you're sober, you're typically not behaving in that manner unless you have a personality disorder, right? Like, that's just not how normal, everyday people behave, especially in front of your children. So he's probably an active addiction. And I may have extended the cooling off period longer and then made him jump through a whole bunch of hoops before he got back to some kind of possession or access. And then even then, it would have been supervised until such time that he had an extended period of sobriety underneath his belt. Because as everyone knows, when you do sobriety, like the first year is the hardest year. It's the most difficult year. And so for me, for him, he's had so many, based on what we've just discussed, so many dips, right? So many bad actions in just a short period of time that to me, he is truly unraveling and needs some time to pull himself back together. So from the bench perspective, that's how I probably would have analyzed it.
In February 2006, when the 30 days ended, Charlie resumed supervised visits, which consisted of 2 daytime visits per week with the nanny present. The following month, Charlie's visits were supposed to increase, 1 day on the weekend and 1 during the week, but he didn't stick to the schedule. By the end of March, even though he hadn't been consistent with visits, Charlie asked for overnight visitation. Denise knew that he frequently had sex workers over at his place, so she declined.
I gotta tell you, I really don't like in this scenario that the nanny was the supervisor. I think that puts the nanny, who is probably unqualified to be a supervisor in this position, to me, it should have been a third-party professional paid supervisor, because funds aren't the issue in this case. And if it had been my case, my client today, and these were the facts that I knew them to be, I would have said, why would you put that nanny in that position, number one? Number two, they're not going to be a witness that can stand up on the witness stand and be completely independent, right? Because they are paid by one of you to watch the children. And so that brings in some bias. And so when you're looking at credibility of a witness to determine whether that witness is telling the truth or not, one of the attorneys will be able to beat up on that nanny on credibility.
I'm just going to throw this out there. Who do you feel was paying for the nanny services?
Probably Charlie.
Okay. So if that was the case, then most likely the nanny would be more loyal to Charlie. I mean, allegedly.
Which creates a problem if you're looking for true supervision to ensure the safety and welfare of the children.
Could Denise have requested a court-appointed supervisor during visits? And if so, who incurs that cost?
So I can't imagine why she wouldn't have been able to request it. That being said, a court could have said, nope, we're not going to do a third party. The nanny is fine. I don't know the facts and circumstances. I don't know what the testimony was. So a court could have said no to that. But on third party supervision, it's whoever the court orders to pay for those fees. And they may make it subject to reimbursement down the road. But usually the person that's the screw up is the person that has to pay for the supervised possession or access. You typically do not punish the innocent party by saying you have to pay for the bad actor to see the kids. That wouldn't make any sense.
Let me ask you this, is that most likely supervision, or at least from a legal standpoint, is out of the scope of work for the nanny's services, most likely, right? I mean, the fact is that if they trust somebody with their kids to be the nanny, they're going to trust them to be able to testify in court if they need them to, hopefully, right? Based on the circumstance.
Maybe. I mean, to me, I want someone who's a professional supervisor that notices the signs of intoxication, that notices the signs of someone under the influence, that notices whether the kids are comfortable, not comfortable. There is so much more that goes into supervised possession or access, especially when there was a cooling off period. And then also from the bench perspective, I would have built in benchmarks that he could not have stepped up to the next level of visitation absent him meeting each and every one of those visits timely and according to the schedule. Otherwise, he can't step up. I mean, that's what I would have ordered.
There's 2 comments I want to make here. One is, let's say this was out of the scope of the nanny's duties, that if Charlie was the one that we assume is paying for this, then if he were able to give her, let's say, more money to be able to fulfill this role, that would put her in a bias towards him, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Number 2 is, based on Charlie's behavior, I'm assuming they wouldn't want a lot of these details to become public about his lifestyle. So the nanny's already accustomed to those things. So does that make her sort of in a bad position to okay or at least tolerate some of his behavior that many of the courts would find inappropriate around children?
Well, I think that's exactly the issue. I mean, that's exactly the issue, is you're putting someone who's untrained, paid by the person, to report on the person. Yeah, that's not likely to happen.
Yeah. And we're speculating because we don't know who hired the nanny. Obviously, they both feel comfortable with the nanny at this point. So however that has gone down, we're speculating. But I just wanted to bring that up because I think that in that position, if someone wanted to turn to the courts and say, please order someone to supervise, because that would be an unbiased, or at least the closest to unbiased, determination is to have somebody
correct,
completely outside of either of them with no personal attachment to them. However, there would be cost incurred, I imagine.
Well, you know, and that's the funny thing, you know, back in our very first, not our first episode, but like the bonus episode about Family Law 101, these are the types of people that are also involved in the family law court system that no one really thinks about, which are professional third-party supervisors, because there is a need for that, especially in cases where there's severe mental health issues or drug abuse issues. On April 9th, Charlie called to say goodnight to the girls. He and Denise spoke briefly on the phone. Denise stated in court documents that during the call, Charlie told Denise he was angry. Denise responded that she was deeply concerned about the children spending the night at his house, given what she'd been told about his ongoing involvement with sex workers, gambling, and pornography. Charlie didn't deny it. I gotta tell you, I give him credit for being really transparent about his issues. I really do. But again, Charlie didn't deny it. Then he said he no longer agreed to the custody stipulation he previously agreed to. He told Denise it was laughable and said he'd only signed it to gain access to his kids, never intending to follow the terms. Denise pleaded with him to get an apartment to have sex in and to stop hosting sex workers at home. Charlie told her it was none of her business and called her a fucking cunt. God, I hate that word. Denise told him her only concern was the safety of their children.
I need to call out something because when it gets to this point where the significant other is pleading with the partner to actually get an apartment to have sex in because of the debauchery and the vices that they're engaged in, what kind of condition do you think she was in to have to normalize this stuff and actually make practical decisions about stuff that probably most people would never tolerate?
I don't envy her situation, but I do, because we're going to talk about this on the next Charlie Sheen marriage, because what she did for Brooke with the twins, Bob and Max, and she owed no obligation to Charlie. Let's be real clear. Didn't owe any obligation to Brooke or those twins. But when I see what she did, that is a woman who values the other parent's involvement in the children's lives and understands that they do have a role to play. That being said, if you're going to engage and not follow what we need you to follow, then just do it where the kids are never going to see it. And so it's out of desperation. It's you're fine. You're not going to get better, but these girls need you. And that's what she did for Brooke. It was these boys need both their mom and dad. So Denise took those boys in. So the siblings stayed together while the parents got help. I mean, it really kind of goes to who she is at her very core.
That's when Charlie said something Denise found especially cruel. He told her he hopes she gets breast cancer and dies, and gets cancer in her face and dies. He knew this would hurt. Denise's mother had battled cancer, and one of her closest friends had just completed breast cancer treatment. Denise hung up.
When people get that low, it's hard to describe just how awful that feeling is in the pit of your stomach, that the person you tried to help for so many years, the person you tried to keep sober, the person you tried to do the right thing for your girls, the person that you really were there for, would stoop to that level. That is epically cruel. There are things in life, things are said that sometimes you can't come back from. 3 days later, on April 12th, Charlie dropped the girls off at Denise's house. After Denise put the children to bed, they spoke again by phone. Denise told him that if he moved forward with the court proceedings to request overnight visitation, she would have to tell the truth about what he'd done. Charlie told her, "You'll never get to the court because you'll be fucking dead." He added, "Enjoy your parents while they're still around." That was the final straw. Denise filed a new restraining order, this time through the regular court system, not through the private judge. She requested that Charlie have only monitor visitation with both the children's nanny and a police officer present, limited one weekday and one weekend visit per week, consistent with their existing agreement.
Denise said filing the order was incredibly difficult. She knew it would make headlines and she didn't want that. But she could no longer accept Charlie's abusive, threatening behavior or the risk it posed to her and their children. She said she needed to stop the cycle of violence and the ongoing threats to her life.
Here is what she did. She tried to manage him. She tried over and over and over again to manage him and to protect him, which is quite often what victims do. They still try to help. They still try to protect that person. Like, she didn't want him to be harmed, but he gave her no choice. I mean, she really tried to protect him. She tried and tried and tried, and she couldn't manage him. And that's what people need to take away from someone like that's behaving in this type of fashion. You cannot manage them. The only person that can manage them is themselves. And until they want to, you have to protect yourself. And that's what she finally realized she had to do.
Charlie denied the accusations and released a statement that read, "Obviously, what has taken place is vile, is unconscionable, is without merit, is a transparent and immature smear campaign designed to hurt, embarrass, and ultimately extort me. For the sake of my children, I am electing not to reciprocate in kind." A close friend of Charlie told the Daily News that Denise exaggerated the claims after Charlie requested overnight visits with her daughters. The friend said, "That's what this is about. It's extortion." In the end, the judge ordered Charlie to stay 300 feet away from Denise and the girls, except during supervised visits.
The judge's ruling tells me everything I needed to know about that. I love the, "I'm electing not to reciprocate in kind." I'm thinking, no, you can't reciprocate, so you're keeping your mouth shut. I mean, that was my favorite. Things were pretty low key after the restraining order went into effect, which is what restraining orders are intended to do, calm things down. In November, Charlie and Denise's divorce was finalized. The terms weren't publicly disclosed, but we do know a few key things aside from the fact that they didn't have a prenup. We know that Denise was awarded primary physical custody. Charlie had visitation rights and paid $55,000 per month in child support. It's unclear if she received any type of spousal support. In an interview on Just Be with Bethany Frankel, Denise said she never went after Charlie's 2.5 men money, even though she could have. I have a comment on that because she just wanted out, which is she picked her battles and she got what she wanted and she wasn't going to pick the battle that he was going to fight her the hardest on so she could get out. But that's my commentary on it. "I think I would have deserved every fucking penny with what I had to deal with," she said. "The money was the last thing we dealt with. It was more about the custody of our daughters and all that stuff." While Denise and Charlie's divorce was finalized, the legal battles weren't over. The exes would continue fighting in court. Meanwhile, Charlie had already moved on. He started dating someone new, and before long, they were married. But that relationship would also turn violent, and it too would end in divorce. All of that is coming in part two. So, final thoughts after talking about Denise and Charlie. And I think for me, the biggest takeaway is just how much addiction and vices can affect a divorce with kids. You take away the money, you take away the private planes, you take away some of the resources they have, and they are no different than any other family with addiction issues that walk into a courtroom. And so you really can get some takeaways from this as just a general listener, because when you're dealing with someone with addictions, you cannot manage them. And Denise, God bless her, she tried and tried and tried, and she couldn't, no matter what she did. What we take away as practitioners who deal with addiction quite often in family law cases is you have to treat the addiction. And until you can treat it, and the court can't force them to, court can order them to, but they have to fix it on themselves. And until they can do so, there is about nothing a court can do or a party can do to solve the problems, which means solve the issues for the kids, protect the kids. You can put all the systems in place, but until that person addresses their addiction, you're stuck. And it's a terrible place to be as a parent who really wants the children to be involved, because for the most part, at the end of the day, so long as you have two healthy parents, children benefit from spending time with both. And that I see in court happen a lot, where it's, "I don't want him or her to have access to the children." And not for reasons that what Denise had. Denise had legitimate, viable reasons to protect those children. But I have cases that I see where, nope, I just don't want him to be involved. And they, people don't realize just how harmful that is to the children. Denise did see how important Charlie was, but she also wanted protections in place. And so she did the best she could. And I think she should be commended for that. I think Denise even recently has gone through some things in her life with her current husband. And we don't know what's happened in that. None of the facts really have come out other than we have a picture with her with a terrible black eye. All I know is that even celebrities have human issues that they go through, that their celebrity status doesn't change. And I think that's the important takeaway, is that walking into that courtroom, doesn't matter who you are. You have addiction issues. The court's going to likely issue orders to protect those children. Thank you for joining me on today's episode. I'll be back soon with a brand new one. And remember, there are lots of four-letter words in family law, and fair isn't one of them. Until then, I'm Michelle Locke, and this is Love, Lust, Law. Love, Lust, Law is hosted by me, Michelle Locke. Jake Deptula is executive producer. Haley Gray is producer, writer, and researcher. Jared Landis is sound editor and mixer. Want to reach out to me? You can. You can email me at hello@michellelocke.com. Want to find out what I'm up to? You can follow me on Instagram at Attorney Michelle Locke. Just remember, Michelle is spelled with one L, and you can thank my mother, Margot, with no T for that.